Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Earlier this year, the National Labor Relations Board ruled that college football players at Northwestern University are to be considered employees and could form a union. The NCAA and Northwestern University promptly appealed the ruling, arguing that student athletes are not employees under federal law. The two sides might see some resolution as early as next week when the House Education and Workforce Committee will hold hearings on the case in D.C. The pay-for-play model is just one issue in the broader college athletes' rights movement. And here to discuss some of those issues that NCAA athletes face is Mark Edelman. He teaches law and writes about legal issues in sports for Forbes.com. Mark, welcome to Word of Mouth.
My pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start with those college football players being considered employees. Players claim that scholarships are not enough for a college football player today. Well, why not? Lay out their case for us.
Well, first, if you look at what the college industry involves, the NCAA collectively is an $11 billion enterprise. And within that, some of the larger universities, such as the University of Texas and the University of Alabama, bring in revenues that exceed $140 million per year.
Wowie.
That means that these programs bring in more revenue than any NHL team does in a given year, and more than the majority of the NBA teams do. Given the pool of money that's created, it often goes into college coaches' salaries, where they make multi-million dollars per year, and athletic director salaries. But the agreement that's been reached by the 1,066 NCAA member schools is to keep college athletes' salaries at zero, or at what they're calling the scholarship amount, which means that this is not the independent decision being reached by any given school, but rather a form of collusion amongst them to keep the money in the hands of the coaches and athletic directors and away from those that are performing the work as the labor force.
Is that true? Aren't they making the case that professionalizing student athletes kind of destroys that ideal of the pursuit of athleticism for its own sake? What do you think of that case?
You know, that argument certainly could be made, but the question then becomes, at what point are you professionalizing them? The college athletes that play basketball at many Division I schools are pulled out of the classroom for more than a quarter of a semester to play in games. The NCAA tournament in men's basketball that we all love to watch, their games are played on Thursday and Friday in the first few rounds, and then on a Monday night in the final round, which pushes them out of class for an additional Monday and Tuesday. So the reality is completely separate and apart from the college athletes' rights movement. College sports has become a multi-billion dollar industry, and one which removes the athletes from the educational experience for the purposes of playing sport to drive revenue to the university, their coaches, and athletic directors.
And, of course, we've heard an awful lot about safety concerns in the NFL, about concussions for college athletes, a lot of different contact sports equally so. What would status as an employee give them? Any protections in case of injuries?
Well, as an employee, if declared an employee, the athletes would be allowed to vote to form a union. If they unionize, they would become then allowed to bargain with their employer over the mandatory terms and conditions of bargaining, which are hours, wages, and general working conditions. While most people focus on the wages aspect as a benefit of unionizing, even if the players choose not to focus on wages, they could focus on working conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So this certainly would create an opportunity to have greater safety in the games, more concussion protocols, better helmets for protection. As well as it could open up the door for health insurance and long-term disability payments to the players who are injured, which the players do not currently receive.
I'm curious about the role that the Northwestern football coach played in this case. Do you know how much he gets paid, by the way?
My guess is it's somewhere in the seven figures.
Oh, wow. Now, he is an employee of the school, yet his job is to be an advocate for his players and stand up for them. How did he come down on this press for professionalizing athletes?
Well, I think a lot of blame could be put on not just him, but his employer, Northwestern University, and the NCAA. There's certain limits under labor law what a prospective employer may do to discourage unionization. But based on the statements that have come out from the coach as well as a long manual that was put together by Northwestern and the NCAA, it seems as if they did everything legally within their power and extended as far as they could to deter unionization and to encourage the players to believe that if they did unionize, there would be bad things that would happen in the future, even going so far, rumor has it, to calling the parents of these athletes and encouraging them to encourage their kids not to unionize.
Has anybody run the numbers of this $11 billion that the NCAA currently makes in annual revenue, how much it would cost to pay the players, let's say, a union wage if they decide to unionize?
Well, one way of putting it in perspective would be, and I can't work with the full $11 billion, and there's all different types of ways to split up the money. But here's one that I just like for comparison. The NCAA men's basketball tournament this year included 68 teams.
Mm-hmm.
The revenue derived purely from broadcasting the NCAA men's basketball tournament, and this is broadcasting alone, was approximately this year $770 million. Mm-hmm. Now, this is just for broadcasting the tournament. If you took that $770 million and allotted 45% of it to the players that played in the game, and I'm not saying this should be done or has to be done, but because 45 to 50% of derived revenues are what the professional athletes get.
Uh-huh.
And then you took that amount and divided equally amongst the 15 players from superstar to last bench player on the 68 teams that played in the NCAA men's basketball tournament. $340,000 per player.
Wowie.
Per year.
Wowie. That's a lot of money. But, you know, you're pointing to something here. People love the NCAA tournament, not just because the challenge of picking their bracket, but because they are non-professional athletes. There is this kind of beauty of playing the game for the game's sake. What do you think, besides the colleges and the NCAA who are opposing this idea of professionalizing student athletes, what do you think of those on the other end, the viewers?
You know, I don't think we're being honest with ourselves here if we say that the viewers watch because these people are playing purely for the passion of the sport. I think if you looked at the Division III schools, there would be a lot of truth to that. If you look at where I teach at Baruch College, there is not a lot of money involved. The athletes generally don't go pro. It really is a labor of love. But here, to say the athletes aren't professional, you have to ask yourself what it means to be not professional. They're escorted to games on jets, sometimes on private jet. They're removed from class days about a quarter of the year. Their performances endorse all types of products, ranging from Allstate Insurance and Audi, on the other hand, to even things like different types of alcohol that are advertised on the game, even though the athletes many times are not even old enough to be allowed to drink. To an objective watcher, I don't know how you could construe them as anything less than professional, but for the fact that they're not getting paid.
Mark Edelman is with us. He's an associate professor of law at the City University of New York at Baruch College. He also writes about legal issues in sports for Forbes.com. Mark, during the March Madness men's basketball tournament this year, UConn point guard Shabazz Napier caused quite a stir, saying that he sometimes goes to bed hungry. Now, are there or were there NCAA rules around food and making sure that their players are actually healthy enough to play?
There are NCAA rules, or there were at the time, surrounding food, but they were just the opposite of what you suggested. It was not to ensure that they were healthy enough to play, but the NCAA member schools had gone so far to ensure that one school didn't have the opportunity to compete monetarily on favorable terms against other schools that not only were you not allowed to pay your student athletes in cash, but you also were not able to pay them in food beyond a set amount. And it went right down to the ridiculousness of limiting cream cheese on bagels.
What?
That's right. This cartel arrangement, which curbs what student athletes can make and ensures the money stays with the colleges, goes straight down to how much food can be provided and what type of food can be provided to the college athletes.
Well, Mark, we're pretty clear about which side of this, where you stand on this issue. It is going to be discussed on the floor of the House next week. Why is Washington so interested in this case?
Well, if you think about what Washington is made up of, or what Congress is made up of, you're going to have the Congress people from each of the different states. And an unfortunate reality here is we almost have a natural conflict. Many of the largest sports schools in the country are large public institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And the status quo is profitable for the institutions and the senior employees. If you think about it, the two schools I mentioned earlier, both Alabama and Texas are state schools. The University of Michigan is a state school. Ohio State University, the University of Connecticut. Many of the worst offenders in this are actually run at the bottom line by the states in the United States.
How about for labor and the general anti-union feeling sentiment that have been predominant in American politics for the past, I don't know, 10, 15 years?
I mean, this goes right to that same theme. Now an additional group is looking to unionize. Of all things that I think have been an embarrassment so far, I think the state government in Ohio has been the absolute biggest embarrassment in all of this. They have begun to take steps to passing a statute to make sure that under Ohio law, there would be a statutory prohibition on the college athletes to unionize.
Any predictions on how this is going to play out next week?
The ruling that was already reached found that the college athletes operated to the benefit of the schools, and that seemed to be very clear, and that the football players at Northwestern University that were under scholarship were also under the direct control of their school on a year-round basis, from where they lived to what cars they drove, to what they did during the off season and what they may and may not put on Twitter and Facebook. Again, that seems correct. I'm not saying that the college athletes necessarily should unionize, but I believe that the decision was correctly reached, and they should be allowed to vote to form a union should they choose to do so, and I believe logic there will prevail, and the decision will be upheld.
Mark Edelman, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Mark Edelman, he's associate professor of law at the City University of New York at Baruch College. He writes about legal issues in sports for Forbes.com, and you can find a link to read several of his articles that he's been writing about this issue. Links are at wordofmouthradio.org. While the fight over pay-for-play rages on for college athletes, another fight is brewing among fitness fanatics. Up next on Word of Mouth, the CrossFit craze. Whether CrossFit is a great workout or a dangerous obsession, devotees don't take criticism kindly. Stay with us for that story after the break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The life of a fitness fad tends to burn hot and fast. Think Jazzercise or the Thighmaster. But one workout craze that seems to be getting stronger with time is CrossFit. It's a variety of high-intensity weightlifting and calisthenics. One reason CrossFit has become so popular, there are now over 8,900 CrossFit gyms worldwide, is that it works. A number of studies on the workout have shown participants see considerable gains in their fitness. One recent study done by Ohio State University finds that CrossFit might push people too hard, leading to injuries. Now, the owner of the gym used in the study is suing the researchers, claiming that they lied about their findings. Here to talk about the case is Warren Cornwall, a journalist covering environmental science and outdoor recreation. His article, "Why is a CrossFit Gym Suing Scientists?" appeared in Outside Magazine Online. Warren, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So let's get to some of the specifics of the case. Mitch Potter, owner of the Fit Club in Columbus, Ohio, is suing researchers at OSU over the study that they did at the gym. Tell us more about the study and its findings.
Well, the study was really focused on whether people participating in a 10-week challenge at the gym, whether their fitness improved over those 10 weeks. So they tested the participants in the challenge before they began and then at the end. And what the study found was some notable improvements in people's fitness during those 10 weeks. Then in the final publication, they also said that they found that some people had essentially dropped out because of overuse or injuries.
So 9 of the 54 members who went through the test dropped out because of overuse or injuries. So Potterf, the owner of the gym, denies the claims that people dropped out due to injury. What did he say were the reasons for clients not finishing the program?
He didn't go through every single one, but he essentially said that they had busy schedules, they didn't have time to go back for the second round of testing with the scientists. They just had, life was busy, and that they didn't make time to do it for a variety of reasons.
I'm actually reading directly from your article. He said that one participant was a wimp, one couldn't stick to the program because of a knee, one was too fat.
Yes.
So not an entirely sympathetic read of his customers, but I understand this is not the first study done on CrossFit that has found the exercise program to be somewhat dangerous.
Well, you know, there frankly is a shortage of studies that really nail down this question of are people getting hurt more frequently doing CrossFit than any other sports, or are there particular risks? I talked to a number of exercise physiologists who express some concern that people could get hurt doing CrossFit or CrossFit-style workouts, but there's not much in the way of, you know, detailed, strong, you know, scientific studies out there. But a lot of the concerns that I had heard weren't based specifically on studies of CrossFit. They were just based on what these exercise physiologists know about exercise and how they think exercise and training works.
Well, what distinguishes CrossFit? I mean, why might it be getting a rap for being prone to injuries?
It's very high intensity, and that it's high intensity on a lot of days. So every workout has a fair amount of intensity to it, and that you're doing some pretty complicated movements, like weightlifting movements, and a number of the workouts call for either doing as many as you can in a certain amount of time, like as many pull-ups in a minute as possible, or doing them as fast as you can. And when you start trying to do complicated weightlifting movements as fast as you can, or until you're so tired you can't do them again, that's putting you at risk of injury because your form starts to deteriorate.
So on the other side here, Michael Smith, he's a graduate student who is working with Professor Stephen Dever. He is an exercise physiologist at Ohio State. Have they spoken about the lawsuit or the study?
They haven't spoken to me since the lawsuit was filed. They had spoken to me before that. So first they said that the study wasn't really about injuries, that the information about the injuries was really just one paragraph in a much bigger study that was about performance results from CrossFit. So they really felt like it was actually a good story about CrossFit. And then when they submitted the article to a journal, one of the people reviewing the article before publication came back to them and said, well, what happened to the people that didn't come for the second round of testing?
Mm-hmm.
And so then, according to Michael Smith, he went and had a conversation with Mitch Potterf, and descriptions that Mitch offered were consistent with overuse or injuries.
We're speaking with Warren Cornwell. He's telling us about a case in Columbus, Ohio, where a grad student and an Ohio State University professor that conducted a study on CrossFit are being sued by the gym owner who didn't like the results. Apparently, the CrossFit community in general is known as being rather radical or rather diehard. And maybe this case, Warren, gives us a peek into a broader world of sports science and how companies respond when research reflects badly on them. Is this typical? Have we seen cases like this before?
I haven't heard any researchers say that we think you're defensive, so we're going to investigate what's going on. You know, Dr. Dever, when I did speak with him, had already been the target of a lot of criticism from people in the CrossFit community. And when I spoke with him, he basically said, I'm never going to do anything related to CrossFit again because I don't want to deal with this. But suing a scientific journal is kind of a different creature. And I literally couldn't find another case in the courts that looked like this.
Given that,
so pretty rare.
Given that, Warren, what do you think? How do you think this is going to shake out?
You know, a lot of it is going to come down to whether there's information supporting one person's side or another. I mean, the scientists are saying that they talked to the gym owner and that the gym owner, you know, as you read, sort of gave these disparaging descriptions of why people had dropped out. The gym owner says that conversation never happened.
Hmm.
So, you know, maybe some kind of evidence will come to light that will, you know, support one side or the other. And then one attorney that I spoke with also said that it might come down to a question of whether the way the scientists collected their information constituted essentially scientific malpractice. So, you know, that's for the courts to decide.
More will be revealed. Warren, I want to thank you for your time.
Well, thank you.
Warren Cornwall is a journalist covering environmental science and outdoor recreation. His work has appeared in the New York Times and the Boston Globes, among other publications. But we found his article, Why is a CrossFit Gym Suing Scientists, on Outside Magazine online. You'll find a link to read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. When Word of Mouth continues, the story of Anna Jarvis, who spent 10 years trying to establish the Mother's Day holiday and the rest of her life trying to end it. Stay with us for that story when Word of Mouth continues on NHPR.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of Mouth. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. This year marks the 100th anniversary of Mother's Day. Though signed into law by President Woodrow Wilson, it was an activist named Anna Jarvis who is credited as the true mother of Mother's Day. One of the few places you can learn more about her contribution to history is at the Hallmark Visitors Center in Kansas City, which is a little ironic given that Jarvis was obstinately against greeting cards and candy and other commercial aspects of the holiday celebration. Andrew Phillips is curator of the Woodrow Wilson Presidential Library and Museum in Staunton, Virginia, which is also hosting an exhibit on Anna Jarvis and the origins of Mother's Day, and joins us now with more. Andrew, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
What inspired Jarvis to lobby for the creation of Mother's Day?
Ironically enough, it was primarily her own mother. Anne Maria Reeves Jarvis was a leader in the suffrage movement and was particularly active during the Civil War. She started what were called Mother's Day work clubs, which gave help and care to wounded soldiers from both the Union and Confederate side. And she was active with Susan B. Anthony, Harriet Beecher Stowe, and many of the names that are much more familiar to people.
So this daughter of a suffragette, Anna Jarvis, lobbies for the holiday. What did you think it should be about?
Well, in the early stages, it was a much more radical idea of the holiday beyond what we have today. It was seen very much as a way to encourage women of all types to think on their contributions and what they could achieve and where they could go. It became the more commercial holiday where it becomes a much more personal thing. Maybe that's a better way to say it. It became a more personal holiday where I'm honoring my own mother and my own grandmother, as opposed to mothers as a whole.
Mm-hmm. The collective mother, I guess.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So she made an appeal to the president, and Wilson signed the proclamation making the second Sunday of May Mother's Day. What happened next is a little surprising. Can you give us the narrative?
Well, it takes a little while to pick up, like any brand new holiday. It was originally came through Congress as one of those congressional joint resolutions, perhaps akin to the bills that go through renaming a post office. There's not usually a lot of opposition to those, I suppose. But as the holiday grew, particularly in the 1920s, it became the more personal holiday. Hallmark enters into the picture about that time when they start producing Mother's Day cards. And Jarvis was disappointed with the way the holiday developed, to the point that she at one point is arrested for disturbing the peace by protesting against it. Later in her life, she says that she wished she hadn't even bothered starting the holiday, seeing the way it went.
So the holiday that she petitioned for, she begins to petition to take it back.
Yes. She was less successful with that second petition, though.
Right. And interesting because, you know, we've come to call Mother's Day a Hallmark holiday, but it really was Hallmark kind of taking it on board to sell cards?
I suppose you could say that. Mm-hmm. Hallmark and many other companies, they were not alone.
Yeah, and I read actually online that the Florist Telegraph Delivery, which we now know as FTD, actually tried to win Jarvis over by offering her a commission on carnation sales. Do you know if that's true?
I've heard similar rumors. I don't think I've ever seen the source material for that. But the carnations, I mean, they were a big part of Mother's Day. When she originally started the holiday prior to Congress getting involved, she handed out some 500 white carnations to the guests at the very first Mother's Day service, which was held at a church in West Virginia.
She had a pretty sad end as well. What can you tell us about the trajectory of Anna Jarvis?
It's unfortunate, obviously. She was very much a part of the greater women's rights movement that led to the national right to vote and the amendment that gave that right. I believe she passed away in the mid-late 40s, but she was never as well known as some of her contemporaries, wasn't honored the way they were, and became known as the critic of Mother's Day. And it's difficult to become popular when you're railing against the holiday where you're telling your mother how much you love her.
How do you think Jarvis would feel now? I mean, the holiday today, according to Hallmark, racks up sales around 130 million Mother's Day cards will be exchanged this May. What do you think Anna Jarvis would have to say about that?
I suppose it would depend on if she got a fuller view of how we deal with holidays today, compared to Christmas, maybe, or Halloween. Mother's Day is small potatoes in the commercialization department. But again, it really just ties back to she wasn't looking to a personal holiday as much as she was one of women's empowerment, I suppose you could say.
So there is a little exhibit on Anna Jarvis at the Woodrow Wilson Presidential Library where you work, but also, as we mentioned, one at the Hallmark Visitor Center in Kansas City. Did you have anything to do with that as a Wilson scholar?
Yes, actually, Hallmark and the library worked very closely. We exchanged a number of different objects. They gave us about 40 Mother's Day cards ranging from the mid-1920s until today. One of my favorite parts of it is that the one from the late 20s is 25 cents, and you can buy one today for $8 that includes a magnetic removable frame. But we also gave them a number of objects relating to Wilson and to the women in his life, particularly his own mother, the mother of his children, and his three daughters. Mm-hmm. So we worked very closely with them.
All right. Is it just me, but is it a little ironic that the commercialized holiday that we now call a Hallmark holiday that Anna Jarvis railed against is dedicating an exhibit to her at the Hallmark Visitor Center?
I suppose it is a little bit, Hard to say otherwise, but again, it's important to understand, I suppose, the origins of these things. We could look at Christmas again. It's the German Christmas trees and everything that we now see is so instrumental. It was looked at by the Puritans as something to be banned and not celebrated at all. So we've come a long way with a lot of different holidays in this country.
Andrew Phillips, thanks for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Andrew Phillips, curator of the Woodrow Wilson Presidential Library and Museum. That's in Staunton, Virginia. Mother's Day is coming up on May 11th, so do not forget to spend some quality time with the mothers in your life. You can tell them Anna Jarvis would not have approved of chocolates anyway.
Mama, you raised me right. Mama, showed me the light. Mama, through pain and strife. Mama, you gave us life.
When I fell down, you were there to pick me up. When I felt bad, you were there to build me up. Gave everything you had in the world to me, and you made me the man I'm supposed to be.
Jane, even though I don't say it often enough, I appreciate everything you did for us. Never take it for granted, cause it ain't hard to see. The best parts of you were now a part of me. Oh, Mama.
And when it was cold outside, you kept us warm and held us down.
Mom, get out! Oh, in the studio!
Just checking on my guy.
You're making a track, you idiot! Just leave!
Go!
Give my one true love, my heart, my mom.
If you'd like to embrace the ideals of Anna Jarvis this Mother's Day, we recommend thinking outside of the gift box and doing something unexpected and meaningful. Something as simple, perhaps, as sitting down for an intimate conversation. Our next story comes from StoryCorps and allows us to listen one-on-one to one of those intimate moments that can only be shared between a mother and a child. In this case, a very famous mother and a very famous child.
Hi, my name is Yoko. Yoko Ono Lennon. My age is 77. Location is in New York City. And relationship to partner, I am his mom.
Hi, my name is Sean Lennon, or Sean Ono Lennon, or Sean Taro Ono Lennon. Taro being my Japanese name. And I'm her son. So, I get to ask you the questions today. And I'm so often, and you're so often, asked about the Beatles and John Lennon, which is interesting, but I think it would be really nice if we could talk about your life. So, how is it that you were born?
I was born from my mother, who is a Yasuda, and my father, who is an Ono.
And you were essentially disowned from the Ono family, right, because of...
having a very kind of outlandish life.
Right, because they're such a posh conservative family.
Well, you know, my father was a banker, but he was an independent spirit. He was a very good pianist and very much into music.
And he taught you piano, or did you have a piano teacher?
I had a piano teacher because I was born when my father was already in San Francisco.
And your dad was banking here?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Wait, so you're saying you hadn't met him before?
Oh, yes.
And you remember meeting him? How old were you?
I was big. I was 2.5 years old. And the time that I met him, my mother and my father was kissing, and I was looking like this, you know, like, well, maybe he's going to kiss me too.
And he hadn't seen Grandma in 2.5 years?
Yeah.
She must have been so lonely.
Well, probably. But you know, the thing is, you see, my mother was a beautiful, beautiful woman from a very rich family. And my father, that just upset him, you know.
So he felt sort of insecure a little bit.
But you know what happened? So my mother didn't mean it badly, but a chauffeur would take him to the bank every morning. And he said, I don't want to do that because they're going to see me in a Rolls Royce.
So funny, because remember, I would really be upset when you made me go to school in a limo.
Yeah, I know. So the thing is, he insisted that the car would stop 2 blocks from the bank.
That's exactly what I did, remember?
And he walked.
But do you remember I would make the... Well, maybe you don't know, but I used to make the limo driver stop 2 blocks from my school so I could walk to school because everyone else took the bus and you wouldn't let me take the bus because that was a dangerous time.
There was a lot of
people trying to, like, kidnap me and stuff.
I know.
But anyway, it's just funny that I had the exact same experience.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. So it's probably kind of like a DNA memory or something.
Mm.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Well, that was a really fun talk, Mom. Thank you so much. I wish more interviews were like that.
Sean Lennon there speaking with his mother, Yoko Ono, as part of StoryCorps' National Day of Listening in 2010. If you'd like to share that conversation, you can find a link on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, all that has inspired my maternal instincts. So let me ask, did you get your flu shot this year? Do you plan to next year? Well, you may want to get in line. When Word of Mouth continues, the cure for flu vaccine shortages may be found in one of the world's most suspect plants, tobacco. Stay with us for that story when Word of Mouth continues here on NHPR. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention number 140 million doses of the influenza vaccine produced for this year's flu season. But given the limited number of influenza vaccine manufacturing plants in the United States, producers often can't keep up with demand. That gap has led scientists searching for a system to produce vaccines that would take less time and be more agile in a state of emergency. Here with more on an idea being tested on America's tobacco farms is Jesse Hirsch, staff writer for Modern Farmer. He wrote the article, Making Flu Vaccines from Tobacco. Jesse, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So how are vaccines produced today? Can you give us a summary?
Sure. The most common way that they're produced is actually you inject some of the flu virus into a chicken egg, and then you have to see it through to its completion, to its hatching. And then for a variety of reasons, there's a lot of other steps to the process that makes it last about 6 months from the first time when you inject into the egg to when you're actually able to use the doses.
So that's a long time. Obviously, if there were some new sudden strain of flu, it would take 6 months at least to produce a vaccine.
Oh, absolutely. It's really unwieldy, and they've been trying for years to come up with a universal vaccine that would work for all influenza strains, but that's way off in the future. So right now, I mean, keeping a vaccine that's nimble and that is addressing the virus that's out there right now is very difficult.
So a search for a more nimble production model landed on tobacco. How? Were there other plants considered?
There definitely were other plants considered. This company, Medicago, which is based in Quebec, actually started 10 years ago experimenting on plants. They had this technique where essentially you inject virus-like particles into various plants, and then it grows to completion in a much shorter period of time. We're talking about from the moment that you inject it to when you can harvest it, it takes about a week.
Wow.
And then once they refine it and everything else, it's about 3 to 4 weeks. And so they were experimenting on alfalfa for a while, but they realized that this cousin of smoking tobacco actually is a lot sturdier. It stood up to the vaccine because when you inject them with the virus-like particles, the plants actually get somewhat sick. So you need a very hardy plant. And they're quicker, and they can produce more of the vaccine particles.
So this is not that they would just, you know, start injecting this into smoking tobacco plants that already exist in the U.S.?
No. It's a very close cousin of the tobacco plant. It still contains a decent amount of nicotine. So definitely the FDA is paying attention to, is a little concerned about this being the host. However, the CDC, which has already done some tests, shows that there's virtually no nicotine that comes in the final flu vaccine that we would be giving to children and senior citizens.
Well, obviously these things have to be tested. How do these tobacco-aided vaccines work so far?
They've worked at They have not. They're currently in the midst of being tested on humans. It's very, very early stage, but it has been 100% effective when they tested on mice. So we shall see. We shall see when it's actually tested on people.
Jesse, one thing I found curious in your article was discovering that the research is funded by the Department of Defense. Now, what does the flu vaccine have to do with the national defense?
I thought that was pretty interesting as well. I think the thought is there's a few different they have this program called Blue Angel that they set up a few years ago, DARPA program. And this is not the only alternative type of vaccine that they've been testing. There's other places that have tested on different plants, but this seems to be kind of the forerunner. The idea is that the flu that we have now, it's varying levels of danger, but there could be something a lot more serious to come along, and it could be a global epidemic killing lots of people. And it's seen that the Department of Defense would like our soldiers, our military, to be able to be quickly vaccinated so that they would be able to be employed and help out any kind of global crisis.
Let's say that the U.S. tobacco industry does not have a reputation for candor, certainly not associated with promoting good health. Any sense that you have of public opinion when it comes to using tobacco for vaccines?
My thought was that people would definitely shy away from this. I mean, the company that's testing this out is partially owned by Philip Morris, which just sets off big red flags. Whether or not they would be able to convince people, look, this is safe. It's not actually smoking tobacco that we're growing it in. It's just hosting the virus, but we're not actually, you know, using the plants. Ultimately, we're extracting it before we inject into our children. I don't know. It's hard to say how the public would react.
Well, and from an agricultural point of view, obviously putting those tobacco fields and potentially tobacco field workers back to work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jesse, when can we expect to see these new vaccines being made available to the public?
Well, because of the lengthy FDA testing process, it looks like it would not be available before 2018. So it's a little ways off in the future.
Jesse Hirsch, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Jesse Hirsch, staff writer for Modern Farmer. He wrote the article, Making Flu Vaccines from Tobacco. And you'll find a link for more at wordofmouthradio.org. As part of NHPR's series on higher education, A Matter of Degrees, we've been shining a spotlight on college courses that take unorthodox approaches to core subjects, such as the science of superheroes and how to win a beauty pageant, race, gender, culture, and U.S. national identity. Today's class examines popular media in a pretty unexpected way.
Hi, my name is Brendan Riley. I'm an associate professor of English at Columbia College Chicago, where I teach writing and media studies and literature courses. I'm most well known for Zombies in Popular Media, a January session course I've been teaching since 2007.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Well, I like the philosophical questions the best. I find that that those questions get most quickly to the things that students are concerned with. And so the zombie movies that really challenge us to think about how we react to other people and what it means to be part of a community are really useful.
If we start letting people in here, we're going to let the wrong ones in, and then I'm dead. And you know what? I don't want to die.
We're the wrong ones.
Nobody here is sick, and I intend on...
In that regard, I like Invasion of the Body Snatchers quite a bit. We'll use a Showtime movie from 2006 called Zombie Honeymoon, which is really great. The production values aren't fantastic, but the movie has a lot of meat to chew on, so to speak.
Please, I don't know what's happening, but you gotta believe me, you gotta believe me! Please!
How do I know you're not gonna kill me, Danny?
Because I love you.
I've developed a system to warn students about the vigors of the class. Basically, I have this long email that says, "Welcome to the class. Are you sure you want to take it? It's really hard." Which one of my students characterized as the go-away email. You know, I don't see it that way so much as making sure that when they get there, they know it's not just watching a movie every day and talking for a few minutes, but rather it's a semester's worth of work in 3 weeks. I like to think that zombies have hit a sort of zenith since the mid-2000s that they hadn't gotten to yet in terms of being a figure that will be perennially available in the way that vampires are. They've hit a kind of cultural zeitgeist where really anyone you talk to can tell you a couple things about how zombies work, and that's going to keep them in the conversation in a way that they haven't been before that. As to how long I'm going to teach the class, as long as I'm continuing to enjoy teaching it and there are new zombie texts to explore, I can't see myself stopping anytime soon.
Brendan Riley there, Associate Professor of English at Columbia College Chicago, discussing his course, Zombies in Popular Media. We so appreciate your listening time today. The show may be over, but the conversation continues on our Facebook page. As part of NHPR's series, A Matter of Degrees, we'd like to get you nostalgic for just a moment. Think back on those carefree school days and tell us, what was your college soundtrack? Was there an album that you played nonstop? A song you played obsessively that will forever remind you of your college sweetheart? Perhaps a Led Zeppelin blacklight poster on your wall. You can fess up and tell us. Facebook.com/word of mouth. For me, it was all about the mixtape. The Smiths, Cure, the Violent Femmes. How's that for dating me? I'm Virginia Prescott. Let's look toward the future instead. We'll be back tomorrow with more Word of Mouth at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The legend of goons from Manchester schools, spineless swine, cemented mind.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.